Oh, you people, you're here. Just kidding. Welcome. Thank you for joining us for Keeping It Real. We are Keeping It Real. I'm Robert Nasr. I'm joined as always by the brilliant James Valiant. James, how are you doing on this fine Wednesday?
I am fantastic, and I hope things are finding you equally fantastic, sir.
They are. But I've been boning up for this episode. We had a couple episodes recently where I picked out the questions. James was very busy, and they
Thank
were
you.
pretty good. But James, we're back to you choosing the questions. And man, have you picked a set of boom questions. Just I think the insights we're going to get from reviewing these even potentially contentious questions is going to
Yeah.
be enormously valuable for me, for you, and especially for the folks watching. So I've got one eye on the chat, and I'm going to keep an eye out for chat messages, and I'm going to keep an eye out for super chat. We've had some pretty good sessions on the super chat recently, but I want to see it bump up. Who's good with this on the reality show is Megan Ribbons. She calls for contributions the way Yaron Brook does on his show. She is all over people. Okay, we've got $20 worth of super chat. I want to see us go for 40. So folks, we're on the Ayn Rand Center UK. I'm going to make this quick. Not a lot of fundraising today, but it's important. We're on the Ayn Rand Center UK. Makes all of these shows possible. This weekly show, the daily shows, the reality show on the Daily Collective, the amazingly special shows like HBTV on Mondays, the study groups. I won't even give the whole list because it's getting to where it takes too long. You need to be a member. AynRandCenter.co.uk link is right in the chat. You need to be involved in the chat. You need to put in comments your questions, and to make them stand out, put in a super chat, a couple dollars on them or a lot of dollars on them so that we can read your questions out and come up with answers. Maybe not as good as Leonard Peikoff's, but we're working with the book. I think they might be close. That's it. That's all I'm going to say. I want to jump right in. Six questions from James Valiant in Leonard Peikoff's collection, Keeping It Real. And we go to number one. Is it okay? I always love a question that starts off, is it okay?
Is it
God's
okay?
permission, is
Asking
this all right?
permission. It's almost like they're asking permission from a religious authority.
It really, and yet we get such great insights from Dr. Peikoff when they do
We
this, so
do.
I love it. Is it okay, as you once said, for poets to do nothing if they want, no matter how the world is collapsing? Well,
Well, it sounds there like you're like Nero fiddling while Rome burns. You know,
right.
you are you're into your music. You're singing your lament for the fall of Rome and not lifting a finger to do anything as Rome is burning all about you.
Right. And although we're not in Germany and the Ayn Rand Center UK is based in the UK, objectivism sort of is its own land of poets and philosophers. So I get it. I get the question.
Yeah.
And Leonard Peikoff starts off his answer this way. I love it. I listened to the audio version of this as well. I've got a list of how to still connect to those audio versions, even though the links are broken right now on peikoff.com. I will share that out. But Leonard Peikoff starts off his answer this way. I did not say that. I love that they included that in the print edition. I thought it might have gotten edited out. He says, I did not say that. I said, well, they don't have to make saving the world their career or the central activity in their lives. I do think that if we're in a collapsing world, and if they see something that they can do within the context of their schedule, well, they certainly should do it. I was simply stressing that you can't give a person an altruist's career. I want to be a poet, but objectivism condemns me to saving the world. Unquote, Leonard Peikoff, one of his very short answers. And I love it. There's a whole show in that, except I think I've done that show a few times on this is a philosophy for living on Earth and for living your life. And yes, certainly, if you feel that Rome, if you see that Rome is burning around you, well, I don't know. What do you think, James?
Well, if we were living at the time of, well, I bring up Rome on purpose, because if
Yes.
I were living actually at the time, say the century when Rome is completely collapsing to the barbarian invading hordes, there's really nothing as an individual that I probably could have done about it. I could have worked 24/7 to try and save classical civilization, and it would have been to no avail as an individual. I would have needed to have been probably a philosopher on the scale of Ayn Rand's genius. I probably would have needed to catch antiquity before It became utterly Neoplatonic and mystical. I would have needed a larger group. I would have needed to organize earlier. I would need to be a genius on the scale of Ayn Rand. Well, that's not likely going to happen. And so what do we do? And even if I thought, let's talk about today. I have a lot of friends who get depressed at the world around us. They say, look, the Republicans suck. The Democrats suck. We're headed to hell in a handbasket, whichever guy gets elected. And I said, there's a great deal of me that sympathizes with that perspective. I see us going to hell in a handbasket. And so I realized there are things way beyond any individual's capacity to do a darn thing about. And so rather than get depressed about the headlines, which are easy, it's easy if all you're looking at are the newspaper, the internet, the Twitter, the X, whatever they call it now, headlines, to get depressed. Of course it is. The world is in some ways getting better. The world is not in every way. In many ways, as you pointed out, the world is getting better too. But let's assume the totally negative view, that we're headed straight to hell in a handbasket. It still doesn't prevent me from being able to have a happy life, from making my world as happy as if I were living, for example, in the 5th century Rome. I would still do my utmost to have around me people I love, to have a productive purpose that I found fulfilling, to have as much or as rich a life as I could, even in that context, even as it's becoming challenging. Sometimes all we can do, ladies and gentlemen, is to control our own environment, no matter when the world is going to hell around us. If Rome truly is burning and there's nothing I can do, see, but if there is something I can do, and that's what Leonard is focused on here, wait a minute here. If I can be part of a bucket brigade that can save this apartment building and save, you know, people's lives there, I'm going to get out there and be part of the bucket brigade. In other words, my purpose is a selfish one, but that doesn't mean that I'm not going to do what I can to help, because for my own selfish purpose, I don't want Rome to fall. And if I don't want Rome to fall, then I'm going to go out and be part of the bucket brigade, if you will, when Rome is burning, insofar as it can be part of a meaningful bucket brigade. But is your duty to save civilization? Well, I'd ask you, can an individual save civilization? What are you in? What context are you in? See, I believe, for example, the world is going to hell in a handbasket. And what we're doing here at the Ayn Rand Center UK, for example, is doing what we can to prevent that and stop that and intervene in the only meaningful way that we really can. If we're going to prevent the collapse of civilization, this is the sort of thing that will do it. And just another little ad for what we're doing here at Ayn Rand Center UK. We're creating a community, a discussion of these ideas. If you think of these ideas, if ideas control history and that these ideas can save civilization, then become a subscriber, join in our discussions, do what you can. And doing what you can, even if it at the end of the day doesn't save civilization, you're at least getting the fulfillment of doing what you can. You may be planting the seeds for some distant rebirth and renaissance. But the point is, your life is the goal. Your happiness is your aim. And insofar as you can affect the world around you, don't be passive. Of course not. But if it's really beyond your control, what your purpose is your happiness, your life. Never lose sight of that. In any context you find yourself, in any context you find yourself.
Excellent. There's a question in the chat, and I've got to read it because I think I have an answer. Ann M. says, is it too late? And I'm going to take that in the sense in which most people mean it. Is it too late to save the world? Are we on a course of destruction that's going to lead to, you know, at minimum, a bit of a big, big downturn, depression, recession, and at worst, the next dark ages? And my answer to Ann M. is it's absolutely not too late. It is not anywhere near too late. And for all of the things that we've got to fight and all of the reasons why the Ayn Rand Center UK is not just a bunch of nerds talking about books, but really talking about saving the world, for all those reasons, then I think we're going to win. And it doesn't mean we'll have an objectivist world in my lifetime, although we'll work on that. But no, I don't think the world is going to hell. I don't think it's too late. I have a list I call the Ever-Growing Benevolence Bookshelf, and it's on my Substack, robertnaser.substack.com. Just go there, take a look, read a couple of those titles from, you know, classics by Johan Norberg, but also Steven Pinker and Matt Ridley and even Alex Epstein's Fossil Future. And you'll realize that no, we want to stave off the next recession, the next depression, maybe the next mini dark ages. But you know better than I do, James, when Leonard Peikoff talks about how the disaster of Germany, and I mean, I love Germany, Germany's great, but Germany in the mid-1900s, that disaster in the land of poets and philosophers grew out of the poets and philosophers. Well, I believe objectivists, we are the poets and philosophers now. And if anybody's going to save the world or at least have a big, big part in that, I think it's going to be us, including conversations like this and all other conversations we have on the Ayn Rand Center UK. We're not saving the world. We're playing a part. And in that sense, we are saving the world.
That's it.
I don't think that's an exaggeration.
That's exactly it. Never forget, you are part of the world. You're not the world. You can't. One person probably cannot change a historical trend all by him or herself, unless you are maybe a cosmic genius like Aristotle or Ayn Rand or so, at least maybe on the level of Thomas Aquinas. But for the rest of us, lesser mortals, there are still things we can do within our, and we are by no, yes, I have to say that in general, the same bad philosophy that destroyed so much of the 20th century and gave us totalitarianism in the 20th century has not really been corrected. But the correction has begun, and has begun with us, has begun with objectivism, and we're out there promoting it, and we are there. And if anything is going to make a difference, it's us. And no, I agree with you. We're not at the brink yet of some thousand-year dark ages. And so long as there are people like us having this discussion, there's hope, because everyone still has free will. Everyone still has a pair of eyes in their head and a brain functioning. Now, it gets harder and harder as the culture gets worse. But I agree with you. In so many ways, the world is actually better than it's ever been before. Better than it's ever been before. Don't lose sight of that either, my friends. And so long as we're free to have these kind of discussions, yes, there's hope. Don't give up.
Excellent, excellent. Let me jump to question number two, because this is somewhat related. It's a little more personal than the end of the world, but it's... hold on a second. There we go. But I think it addresses the same kind of question. Number two. Is it better to put creative work aside when one is confronting a serious emotional upheaval? Now, Leonard Peikoff explains before he answers. He says, man is working on a novel, and he gives the example that his elderly parents, who have been good to him and are now sick and in need of support, something he has no money to do. It's going to be a long-term situation, very time-consuming on his part. What should he do? He can't just write in fits and starts, an hour or two here and then 2 hours there, but he wants to preserve his enthusiasm. That's the purpose of life. And then Leonard Peikoff goes on. Well, I would say yes, within limits. Yes, you put it off. Because usually a person cannot write a novel in that fashion. You need an unbroken stretch of time. And then Dr. Peikoff goes on, if I can take myself as an example, if I know at 10 in the morning that I have an appointment at 4, I can't write. Even though I know I'm not going to write for six hours, I need that feeling that if something occurred to me, I wouldn't have to break it off. And then he goes on to talk about Ayn Rand, who this has been written about elsewhere, but he says, Ayn Rand, by the way, was exactly the same. I guess I probably learned it from her. If she had a business appointment in the late afternoon, the whole day was gone as far as she was concerned. When she was working on Atlas Shrugged, she had the luxury to write all day. But on We the Living, she had to divide her time, working all day and then coming home and writing at night. The reason was, well, she made an absolute divide. One was working metaphysics, and then she had dinner, and then she went into a completely different world, one in which she had unlimited time. Now, Dr. Peikoff goes on, but I'm just going to start with that point right there, because I think those of us who've done any kind of creative writing at all, we absolutely know that feeling of, yeah, I've got an appointment this afternoon. I can't not think about that this morning and get into that mode of writing? It's hard. It's a real challenge.
It is the nature of creative work. It's the nature of serious mental work. It is in the very nature of it. You have to get into it. There's so many forms of this that come up. When I was an attorney, you're planning out a case or doing research or writing a closing argument or writing out my cross-examination of the defendant, I needed undivided attention. I needed in my mind to load up and hold all those factors in, and I cannot be interrupted in the course of my, and I become a rather demanding person when I'm writing or doing something. And Holly knows, my wife knows, oh no, we leave Jimmy alone when he's doing that. There's nothing that can interrupt him there, because any little, and it, you become, I have to say that I'm probably at my personality worst and most irritable when something, a phone rings, someone knocks at the door, interrupt. They didn't know they were interrupting. Just
No. How just could interrupt. You do this?
I've built up this mental chain, and that's how you feel when you're writing too. I've built up this mental chain. I'm right there. I'm ready to go, and I get interrupted. I'm going to have to go all the way back to the beginning of my mental process. I'm going to have to reclimb the 3/4 of the mountain that I climbed to get back to that moment where I could actually write that one sentence. And I've been distracted. So absolutely, I understand the nature of that, and real creative work, when you're serious about it, requires that kind of devotion, mental devotion. I don't care whether you're a painter, a writer, a lawyer, true study requires that kind of devotion. So when a crisis happens, if my wife, someone calls me at work and says, your wife is in the hospital. Well, wait a minute here. My context has been completely broken. I'm sorry. I need time. I cannot focus on anything other than my wife now needing my help, and I'm going to go to the hospital, and that's it. And my priorities are my priorities, and I'm going to, pending my ability to get my mind off of my wife's health crisis, I'm going to have to put aside my work, find someone else who can do it if it needs to be done today, or I cannot divide my focus that way. Goodness, folks, don't, you know, you think of what objectivists are martyrs to their work. They do work like slaves. They are devoted to what they do. But guess what? They have whole lives. And you really, when a crisis happens in your life, if someone close to you gets sick or dies, when you have a major health problem, or there's some crisis in your romantic life, oh my goodness, something happens. Be good to yourself.
Yes.
Be good to yourself. Just stop. Give yourself that break. Don't whip yourself for saying, hey, I should be out there working on my novel. Whoa, wait a minute here. Your mother is in the hospital. Your wife is sick. You have a crisis in your romantic life. A friend desperately needs you. Stop. Put it down. Put it aside. Focus is what we need. And our lives are more than just our careers. It is. Our central purpose is the most important thing. Absolutely. As objectivists, we stress that so much. But that stress we should not forget that we're complete human beings here. We need to keep the engine going. We have other values that make our life as wonderful as it is, hopefully. And we can't, you know, saying productive career is important does not mean that excludes the importance and the value of any of these other things. I have found in my life, absolutely, there have been times, for example, just with my own health issues, I've had to say, stop, take a breath, give yourself, Jim, the time you need to work this out. Emotionally, psychologically, intellectually, you need the time to feel and to think and to experience, even if it's something you could do nothing about. Someone has died. Give yourself the time to grieve. Give yourself the time you need. Self-care in this regard is, I think, the highest priority of all. Because yes. If I'm going to get back on track with my career and devoted to my central purpose, I've got to be there fully as best as I can. That's not my only value in life. I've got all kinds of other, in fact, those other values serve as important fuel for this. And if I don't attend to that, I won't be as good at that, at this other, as I was before. My life is a complex set of values, all of which need to be kept in hierarchy and need to be given their appropriate attention. And if something big, some crisis interrupts your life, don't think that you have to be some martyr and slave away and be, you know, ignore your feelings. Never do that. Never, ever, ever do that, my friends.
Yeah, don't.
Philosophy of selfishness, not self-abuse.
Yeah, don't think you have to. Don't even think that you can. You know, there's a mistake a lot of us make, especially when we're young, but maybe all the time, in thinking that free will is more than just engaging your mind, focusing your consciousness, but it should be able to overcome anything. You know, free will does not negate context. It doesn't negate psychology. It doesn't change circumstances. We think, oh, I should be able to bulldoze through anything just by choice. And as you suggest, that's not a just thing to do to yourself. It's not a reasonable to do to yourself. And to be honest, it's not practical. You can't do it. You cannot make your mind, your psychology, your consciousness, your emotions, your memories, you cannot make it all go away just because you say, well, I have a goal. I have a conscious purchase, purpose, and that's all I'm going to care about. I'm going to ignore my dying parents and my love life falling apart and everything else because this is the most important thing. Well, great, except it turns out that doesn't work because you can't ignore your values.
In fact, the important thing to do is to focus on the important thing at that time. You know, you say to yourself, well, I've got to keep doing. No. What you've got to do is focus on the important thing, my friends. You've got to keep your hierarchy of values straight. Yeah. So, hey, wait a minute. Your wife was just in a traffic accident. You know, oh, well, you know, I'll get around to worrying about her, you know, or my wife being in a coma at some other later point. No, you're emotionally going to be so overcome, you won't be able to think or consider anything else. You attend to that.
Yes.
You attend to that.
Absolutely.
Without guilt or anything else coming into your focus, even.
Yes.
Put your priority where it belongs at the time.
I'm glad you really brought that out of this question because we've got a reaction in the chat, for example. Amen to that, says Jay Sebastian. I certainly struggled with thinking my free will should just be able to magically conquer anything. Incidentally, earlier in the conversation in regard to the last question, Jace brought up a quote that's out on the internet, and I just looked it up in the letters book. And you see quotes, and you always want to be sure they really were quotes, but it is. In Letters to Ayn Rand, page 636, she was writing to a fan, and she says, again, think about this in the context of this question, and especially the previous one. Dear Mr. Nicholas, John Nicholas, a fan of hers, I can sympathize with the fact that you feel fear when you look at the present state of the world. Man, don't we all feel that right now? But I hope that this is not your chronic emotion. It is too early to feel fear for the future when one is under 30. And too late after that.
Boom. I love that answer.
And then she explains.
Talk about a recognition of the metaphysically given, right?
And then she says, and I love this because this will get into the psychology we were talking about too. She says, what I mean is that one must never allow fear to become one's permanent sense of life. The important thing is to prepare yourself intellectually to deal with whatever circumstances you may encounter, which requires that you define your values fully, clearly, and rationally, and never betray them. Unquote. Right away, she goes to, what can you actually do? Your actual life, the life you're actually living. Read her essay, What Can One Do? For a take on that. When somebody says, what can one do to save the whole world? And she says, when you ask it that way, well, there's nothing one person can do. But then she goes on to say, well, here is what you can do.
This is what we can do. Yeah, no, she, we talk about understanding context. Talk about understanding the submission to reality that's involved. But all, you know, it goes back to that wonderful serenity prayer that Ayn Rand loved to quote, you know, in metaphysical versus the man-made, recognizing what we can control and what we can't control. You just let go, submit to what we can't control. That's just the fact. When we can control it, do what you can. Do what you can. Achieve what you can, the improvement you can, if you can, at least give it the effort when it looks like you can. And of course, the true wisdom is knowing the difference there and being able to make sure we're attending to all of our values appropriately. And there Ayn Rand put her finger on it. It's a question of knowing our values, having rational values. If we introspect and understand ourselves, if we're careful about the values that we do adopt, conscious about it, and they're rational values, and we have our values in their correct hierarchical place, boy, that is really the prerequisite for being able to do exactly that. Make that distinction between what I can't do, just accept it, what I can do something about, okay, and what's appropriate, how much effort should I put into it? And to know that, I have to know my values. My values have to be rational. There's no shortcut with that to get the number two, the second part right. And of course, it sets the context for being able to know the difference. It's that simple. It's that complex. Yes. It's that awesomely complex and broad, but it's also that simple. Know thyself, my friends.
The essay, where she really hammers that point is an essay, and you can find this on the internet, look it up, folks, The Metaphysical and the Man-Made. And she makes exactly that distinction, that what is metaphysical, what is simply out there, there is no evaluation to be made. You can do something about a thunderstorm, about an earthquake, but you don't hate a thunderstorm or an earthquake. Now, what there was choice about, specifically the man-made, man has volition, everything he does could have been done otherwise. There's room for judgment. And either way, what you do in regard to each of those, well, read that essay, The Metaphysical and the Man-Made, because I want to get back to this question. Leonard Peikoff's not done with question number two here, because he points out that, you know, Ayn Rand had to go through different steps depending on where she was in her life, writing We the Living while she was working, writing Atlas Shrugged, where she had been successful enough to devote years to that. He says toward the end there, so she was in charge of the change in focus. When one world was gone, she was in the other, and so there was no problem. Suppose, though, that you can't do that. You literally can't. And this is going to go on long term, not weeks or even months, but years. Well, then I would say you have to choose your novel. Otherwise, you're truly living a life of self-sacrifice. You should still help your parents as much as you can. Within that answer, you should look to friends, insurance, siblings, charity, or whatever. But your creative work has to ultimately be number one in your life. If everything else fails, you have to put your parents in a home, and then you visit as often as you can. At some point, you just have to bite the bullet. And not forever. Some point doesn't mean, 25 years from now, but 6 months, a year at tops. Otherwise, your life may well be eaten away. Now, you're in a horrible conflict, but that's what I would do if I had to make a choice like that. Now, unquote Leonard Peikoff, at first, that seems like a pretty harsh answer, but what's the alternative?
Oh, well, I mean, it's the alternative that's the harsher answer.
Yeah.
We're all slaves to the needs of everyone else around us. We don't get to have a life of our own.
Yeah.
When I have been sick, when I have been sick, when I have needed help, and I have seen, say, my wife, Holly, take time out of her busy life and career and her purpose to be of assistance to me, I'm struggling in my own mind to minimize that, to get out of the way of her having to do that. And if your parents really did love you, if they brought you into this world, they wanted you to have a happy, successful life. They didn't want you to throw your life away just to be their lifelong caretakers. I hope not. If they had you, then they were just breeding slaves. Then they were just breeding. They weren't actually reproducing another independent human being that they actually loved, cared for, and wanted to have a happy life. Now, they weren't doing the benevolent parent thing. They were doing that, well, I'm breeding a slave who will then now spend the rest of their life sacrificing their all of their joys and purposes to take care of me. Well, that would show me that the parents themselves are vicious manipulators on the face of it. My needs are not an obligation on anyone else's part. No one's. I'm going to repeat that. No one's. Everyone has a right to their own life and their own happiness. What is the point if they're not pursuing their own fulfillment, their own goals, their own happiness? Which is, nobody gets a chance. You know, this is that old Peanuts cartoon. You know, the purpose of life is to help others. Well, wait a minute here. You don't know, Lucy has.
What are the others here for?
What are the others here for? Lucy has a different perspective on this whole living for others thing. But there's something very, very important to that. There are people who enjoy taking care of others. They become nurses, they become healthcare providers, that they really find fulfillment in doing that. And whether it's mom needs assisted living, we'll put mom into the best assisted living place I can get mom into so that I can carry on with my own life. If I have to depend, even if I have to depend on charity in order to do something like that, or involve the rest of my family, like Leonard says, to do something like that. But guess what? We have lives too. And we've got to, every life is an end in itself. I appreciate that about my mother, and she appreciates that, I hope, about me. The goal of life is not to be someone else's bandage, and everyone's got to recognize that. You do the best you can when one of your high values is in threat like that, but we do the best we can. We do the best we can.
If I could address the flip side of that, which you've also said, but it's very easy to say, don't let anybody demand sacrifices from you. And no. I agree. I 100% agree. But for those who find that harsh, I have a daughter. And if I ever found myself incapacitated physically or by Alzheimer's, some form of dementia, and if I was going to spend the last 10 years of my life, in a bed, in a home, needing to be tended to, the most heartbreaking thing I can imagine is that my daughter would throw away 10 years of her life to spend it at my bedside.
Oh,
or to God. Be visiting every single day, interrupting the things that she really cares about. And I know she'd be willing to do it. I don't doubt for a minute that she loves me that much. And as a father, I'd probably do the same for her. But I don't want that. She knows I wouldn't want that. Nobody who really cares about you would want that. Even if they're not mean and evil and vicious SOBs who, maybe put on a little bit of that guilt. If they really care about you, they don't want that, even if they think they do. So yes, no sacrifices allowed. I will go to the ends of my earth for my dear mother, but I know she doesn't want me to throw my life away for any reason. And I absolutely, it would break my heart if my daughter had to do that for me. If she thought she wanted that.
No, I wouldn't. No, of course not. That's what loving means. You mean, good God, if you really love your value, if it really is a value to you, you wouldn't subject them to that. Right. My gosh, no. There's nothing I can do about old age. It's going to happen to all of us.
Right.
There's nothing I can do about, there's fatal diseases that are going to, in effect, we're going to get it. There's nothing at the end of the day I can do to stop that. So right. At what point does it become simply, destroying my life to just be one more soft pillow under the person? No.
Right.
Keep your priorities straight. Keep your hierarchy straight. Your happiness is on the table, folks. And what people tend to do when some value of theirs, like mom, is in trouble, they tend to throw their values right off the table and think, this is the evil, one part of the insidious evil of altruism. It really makes you think, well, my whole purpose now must be to fix this problem that someone else has because, gosh, it's mom. No. And as you point out, if mom really is a life-loving, benevolent person, she would not want you to do that. That's not the point. Yeah.
And if people want advice on how to avoid that, there's a very good new book out by Dr. Peter Attia, Outlive. And you can hear his recent interview on Barry Weiss's podcast, honestly, or just listen to Yaron Brooks' review, one of his recent shows he reviewed, maybe it was last night, reviewed that book. And one of the bottom lines of the book is, here's how to stay healthy for the longest time you can, what they refer to as health span versus lifespan, and then to die quickly. And the die quickly part is kind of funny because nobody's going to try to die quickly, but the point is, whatever
well,
you can, remain healthy.
You remind me of a very famous story. You know, there's the torturer, the medieval torturer, who's got the guy on the rack, and the guy says, "Oh, well, I'm so afraid of dying." And the torturer says, "Dying? No, that's never the problem. Oh, dying. Dying is nothing. It's the road to death that can be painfully slow." Wow. Yeah, that's the part. It's this slow road to death that we want to avoid, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, well, Dr. Attia makes that book makes that point very well in his latest book, Outlive. Yeah. So yes, that's that. On the practical side, I would definitely recommend listen to that interview, listen to Yaron Brook on it, and you know, read the book, which you can do on audiobook now. It's actually read by the author, so it's very easy to take that in. And you know, we talked about child and their parents. But as you said, also within a romantic relationship. So let's get back to romantic relationships. Let me jump to question number three, because this one really threw me. Occasionally, and I've mentioned this before, Dr. Peikoff will take a question that really throws me, and then his answer throws me even more, and then I really have to think. Question number three. Is it immoral? Another question. Am I doing the wrong thing? Do I have permission? But then, okay, we'll take it on its merits here. Question number three. Is it immoral for a single professional soldier to seek sex as a release for momentary pleasure, considering that a long-range relationship isn't possible and early death is possible? So, sounds like active combat, or at least the possibility of combat. So, Leonard Peikoff says, under those circumstances, I would say no, it is not immoral. It is moral and okay if his or anyone's career is rational under those circumstances, and the military would be a good example of it. A soldier has an inherently unstable life. He cannot have a long-range relationship, but that does not alter the fact that sex is a huge value in human life and that you should never renounce it unless your only potential partners are diseased or the like. I don't mean a soldier should therefore feel free, even as a soldier, to always on the go to do whatever he feels like. He shouldn't just take the first prostitute he sees because he needs sex. But what he can do is say, well, this woman is not as great as I would ideally like if I had a different life, but I do see value in her as definitely better than nothing. And there are circumstances in which this is perfectly legitimate, in fact, common in the bomb shelters in London in World War II, when they expected the end was coming, and there was a fair amount of sex on the threshold of death because people wanted to reaffirm the value of life. And he goes on. It was very interesting to me that he makes the point. It's similar to the ethics of emergencies. I thought, but this is not an emergency. This is somebody who's chosen this kind of context as at least long-term, if not lifelong, situation. And yet, I agree absolutely with Dr. Peikoff's answer.
I do too. But I don't think that the battlefront scenario that we sort of have here is a lifelong situation, even for most soldiers. I can't imagine that kind of situation. And imagine a war that's going on for years, though, too. And what you're asking someone, a soldier, to say in that kind of a situation is, we expect you to be here on this battlefield for the next 2 years and not have any kind of sexual enjoyment or release. You could die at any moment. This could be the end of your life forever. And we don't expect you to have any kind of emotional fuel for this life and death endeavor that we've sent you out on. And we've put you in a life and death sort of crisis. Sex is, let me just say this, as objectivists, we all say, yes, when it is done healthy and proper, healthily and properly, to put it in the adverb forms, I guess I should, it is a combination of spiritual and physical values and more, like we've said in just in our recent podcasts, it has to be, when done properly, romantic love is our highest values in operation. We're seeking our highest spiritual values in conjunction with physical values. And so for an objectivist to say, wait a minute, aren't we stripping away all that potential for those high spiritual values when we're talking about the soldier here? But no, wait a minute. Sex is a value. Sex is a value. And if there is some, I mean, it's true what Dr. Peikoff says. Even no matter how hard up for sex I was, just picking the first random prostitute there would simply not do it for me. I couldn't do it for me. In fact, I'm not getting that at all. But if there is a value there, and I'm on the edge, I'm in this extremist situation where I could die tomorrow, and this is a value to me, keep context, people. For gosh sakes, keep context, people. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. You're getting a value. It's helping you. You're fueling yourself. You may not be here tomorrow. I mean, we can't appreciate that context that a human being can find themselves in. And we can't appreciate what they're going through in that moment and that they need that kind of spiritual fuel, even if it's just this kind of spiritual fuel compared to that kind of spiritual fuel. My God. It's also a physical value, a physical need that we can't ignore. It's true, as we said in earlier podcasts, in normal circumstances, if this person really isn't a potentially high value, why, self-satisfaction is plenty is sufficient, and I can deal with that. And in that context, there is, like I say, even a line when I'm a soldier out in the battlefield, where, I mean, there's a cutoff here. Self-satisfaction over there behind the bushes is going to be actually a better option than the human value put in front of me over here, of course. But if there is a value, if there is a real value you can get from it, even at a very modest scale, remember that sex is an important human need and value. That's all I can say. Context is everything here, folks, and we're not a religious organization that has the rules of, you know, when sex is what, under exactly what conditions is sex a moral thing. Understand, sex is a really good thing. It's an important value for people, and there are contexts in life that vary radically. I mean, unless you can know the context that a person finds themselves in, even when they're not in war, even in a normal social context, when people, you know, jump on other people for their romantic choices, for example, wow, that gets me really, it bothers me somehow. You don't know that person's context.
Right.
Until you do, you know, you going around judging a person's romantic choice like that or their sexual decision. Now, obviously, if I see someone just sleeping around and counting the notches on their bedpost, yeah, I can say that, look, dude, you're not pursuing the real value there. There's something psychological that you're kind of satisfying in your own lack of self-esteem. Or if someone is celibate on the other side saying, well, no, I'm intentionally going to give up this value that is there for me that I could have, but I'm not going to have. I can say at that end, you know, both of those approaches are wrong. But man, there are a lot of contexts in between. Human situations can be extremely complex, and we have to pay attention to that context. And a soldier at war is one of those. I mean, you're sent away, you could die tomorrow, you're going to be years away from your home. You're telling me that he can't find some sexual release, satisfaction, happiness, find that value at some level? No. I would never do that to someone. I would never condemn them to an utterly sexless, totally, even without any aspect of that kind of human interactive value. No, that's inhuman.
You know, going back to the kind of practical advice we were talking about early in the episode, it's not that you don't have reactions and opinions and even judgments about other people and the relationship choices they make, but you know, or should know, and should bear in mind, you only know as much as you know. You're not in a position to make an objective judgment.
That is
many, true. Many times. And in that case, it's great to have a strong opinion and to know, you know, by my values, which I'm really passionate about, these two shouldn't be together, or this gal shouldn't have done what she did, whatever it is. But yeah, to be able to also say, well, I don't know everything. I don't know his context. I don't know what these two mean to each other.
Before we go judging other people's sex lives or love lives, we need to have the full context, which we almost never have. Now, right. Like I say, there are cases where you can clearly make, you know, judgments, obviously. Sure. This is an important human need, people, and people find themselves in all manner of contexts, and that has to be accounted for.
Right. Yes. But know in your opinion, in your own mind, when your opinions are just provisional, and yeah, you may be right, and it's great for you to have those opinions, but they're not something to hold up protest signs or go on the battlefield about or to condemn people over until you really know.
Right.
Sometimes it's okay to say, I don't know everything about this particular situation. I have strong feelings about it, but I don't know everything.
Yeah, subjectivists, you know, we need to get that. We really, really need to get that a lot easier to come out of our mouths. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Right. But that doesn't make it nothing. It doesn't mean I don't care. It doesn't mean I don't have strong opinions.
Right.
I think it's that in-between part that's hard for objectivists. Sometimes we can say, I don't know, but then we feel like, well, then we shouldn't have anything to say, shouldn't think anything, shouldn't have any reaction.
I don't have values. I don't have ideas. Right. Yeah.
But no, if I don't know everything, but I know something, I may feel very passionately about it. And yet at the same time, I'm not going to try to tell you what to do or condemn you when I don't know everything.
Right.
So, context is everything. It's how you can be both moral and practical, is that respect for knowing what you know. And if you don't know everything, knowing that too. And that brings us to question number four. I'm experiencing a conflict between what I want and what is practical. I think we've discussed this one before, but in this context, this is going to be very different. I want to write nonfiction, but I also don't want to worry about money, where my next meal is coming from, buying new shoes and so on. What should I do? Well, I think we've all faced that question of, okay, I finally figured what I want, and what I want to do for a living is underwater basket weaving, or or I want to be, you know, the philosopher that takes Ayn Rand's ideas and brings them out in the world. I can't figure out how to make any money doing this thing that I want to do, and so the moral must not be the practical.
Oops. And there is, but let's face it, ladies and gentlemen, you know, we talk about finding the thing you love to do, finding the thing that you find most rewarding, that which fits you and so forth. But there's also a simple practical question, ladies and gentlemen. At root, we are each responsible for our own survival. At root, nobody owes you or me anything. We've got to do it for ourselves. We each confront the problem of survival on our own. And that imposes a very simple, basic, practical necessity. I've got to worry. I don't want to worry about where my next meal is coming from or if I can afford another pair of shoes. So what about that? I mean, it's just not a simple, practical level here. I need to survive, which is a real question. And do you always have every option under the sun to choose? Well, gee, I'd much rather be a, you know, an artist over here than have some practical job at Dunkin' Donuts selling coffee. But sometimes we've got to take the job at Dunkin' Donuts selling coffee. And if that's the context that we find ourselves in, that's the context we find. Gosh knows, when I was younger, I found myself in those kind of contexts, working in a factory or being the sales clerk at a bookstore or something. And we've all, I think, been around that block. I mean, we start out maybe in a machine shop in a factory, or we start out as a sales clerk in a shop. But those are the kind of jobs that we have to do just to feed ourselves and make possible, hopefully, funding ourselves to get into a position where we can pursue the career that we really find rewarding and most enjoyable. But that's it's a question of the law of cause and effect. The law of cause and effect doesn't allow you to jump out of Zeus's head as a brain surgeon. And for Ayn Rand, you know, we were talking about getting back to Leonard about talking about the difference between her context with We the Living and Atlas Shrugged tells you everything. But when she was writing Atlas Shrugged, she was taking odd jobs, jobs she hated. She was selling newspaper subscriptions door to door. Can you imagine a job less suited for someone like Ayn Rand selling door to door newspaper subscriptions for the Hollywood Reporter in Los Angeles? I cannot imagine a job that would have made her more miserable, or that it was, I think, is a poorer match. Now, she did have a job that, again, it wasn't her the thing she loved. It wasn't that she this is what she wanted to do, but she got a job in RKO Studios in the costume department. And within a year, she became head of the department. So when she found a job that she could do well and she could enjoy, no, she doesn't want to hand out costumes to actors. She wants to be a novelist. And so all she can do is find little stretches of time where she can devote herself to writing We the Living while she's doing these other jobs during, mind you, America's Great Depression. She's having to find all these odd jobs. She and her husband are working their tails off doing jobs that aren't the job that they ultimately want to do. But at some point, it did put her into the position when We the Living and Fountainhead came out. Finally, with the huge success of the Fountainhead, now she can devote herself full time to her writing. You know, we want to do the thing we most love doing, but there is a little thing called cause and effect. Put ourselves in a position where we can.
Yeah, if productiveness is a virtue. If you're going to choose something as a vocation, it can't be a hobby. It has to actually be producing something of value in the world. And that's not subjective. Value, we know from economics, value can be both social and objective. You've got to choose something that's actually productive, an instance of productivity. You've actually got to create a value, that something that is of value out in the world. And, you know, underwater basket weaving just doesn't Phil, there aren't enough people who are interested in buying wet baskets.
Especially water baskets.
Yeah. I totally get the quandary of, well, what I want to do is, and then it ends up being halfway reality based and halfway just your feelings. And you've got to ask yourself, yeah, what do I want to produce? What is the work, the actual work, the actual creation, production that I love?
Right.
And then what does that look like in the real world? I'm not saying that's an easy task, but if you can at least ask yourself, well, when I figure out what my vocation, not just a job, but my career is going to be, what do I want to produce? What do I want to create? What am I proud of doing that is of some value, that actually generates and creates values? That can help in trying to advise people about not just what kind of jobs they should take, but what kind of career they should pursue. Right. Because I totally get our questioner here who says, you know, I want to write nonfiction. Great. What kind of nonfiction do you want to write? And who will be interested in that? Not subjectively, but really, what is the value of what you're producing? And how would you then find a publisher and market it, or self-publish and publicize it yourself? And so let me read some of Leonard Peikoff's answer, because I think what you and I have said is good, but I've got to get this in there. Leonard Peikoff says, the first thing I would say, and I love this, he gets into obviously the real philosophy aspect of it. First thing I would say is that choice is not sacrifice. Anytime you act, you are selecting one course over another. That doesn't mean you're sacrificing the first for the second. Sacrifice is defined by your hierarchy of values. If you choose the higher value and give up the lesser, well, that's not a sacrifice. That's your choice. Now, if you choose the lesser and give up the higher, well, that is a sacrifice. And you have to decide in an issue like this, which is the higher value to you. Now, you know yourself best, so you know your own hierarchy. But if I just took the question straight, I would advise you, well, go with the practical career, not with the writing. Let me stop for a second there. As I say, we've discussed this one once before. Every time I hear that, my jaw drops. But Leonard Peikoff goes on. Writing, at least to the best of my knowledge, is a tremendous struggle. It has the potential to make you miserable from the demands of creativity. I would only advise a person to take that kind of career if they have a passion for writing, such that all these other things, shoes, and restaurants and nightclubs and so on, are irrelevant. If these other things are important to you, well, that's perfectly okay. It's perfectly moral. There's no obligation to go into a profession like that. There's no obligation to go at all, easy or hard, if you prefer a different kind of life and you are still using your mind productively. And then he wraps up real short here. I'll finish this. And then, of course, we're all thinking Whiplash, right? The movie.
Why were we all suddenly thinking Whiplash?
If you do choose, well, non-writing for that valid reason, then I would say do it guiltlessly. Don't right. feel, oh, I'm just doing the practical and abandoning the moral. In your context, if you are weighing values appropriately, you should be guiltless and enjoy your new shoes, unless it kills you not to write. In which case, well, then you don't care that much about the shoes. Unquote Leonard Peikoff. It's such a great answer because, again, my jaw drops. What do you mean don't write if that's your passion? But he's making the point that some careers are very hard to actually make a vocation, to actually make a career, a productive career, earn a living. And if you want to be a writer?
Nonfiction, mind you.
Nonfiction. Well,
all I want to do is write nonfiction books. The first thing out of my mouth is going to be get ready for a life of poverty. Writing nonfiction books is not the key to becoming Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos. I promise you, or Elon Musk, that's not the way you're going to do it. I guarantee you, right off the bat, nonfiction writing will not generally. I mean, there are exceptions, but man, talk about exceptions. But, you know, even where there are careers where you can become really successful and rich, but of only a teeny percentage of people, like acting in Hollywood. If you want to be a movie star, an actor in Hollywood, man, there are a million people out there for every one little opening of a job that they have. And they're looking for very, very specific qualities when they're casting films. And you better be prepared. Some of these careers, if that, the thing about being, and the most important part about being career, being prepared is this career your passion? Is it really that big of a value? Things like shoes, I can wear the shoe with a hole in it for the next, you know, I can put off buying a pair of shoes. Is that career really worth it to you to say just things? That's the kind of decision you have to make in your own head. Look, I love writing so much that I'm willing to wear this stupid old pair of shoes with holes in it for the next 2 years, even though I'm going to have to wear shoes like that. I still need to write. And that's still more important to me. When that's your value, then even a career where it looks like, geez, yeah, I may have some real problems putting food on the table. But that's when it makes sense, though. That's when it absolutely makes sense. If it doesn't make sense to you, you know, I love philosophy. As anyone who heard these programs love philosophy, Leonard Peikoff once asked me in his living room, he said, Jim, you seem to love objectivism. You seem to be interested in it. Why don't you become a professional, get your PhD and become a teacher of philosophy, a real philosopher? And I said, well, I gave him my own personal reasons. You know, I need to see the feedback in my own, you know, Leonard, I said, you're never going to see the real effect of your work in your lifetime. He said, well, that's true. That's true, Jim. Well, I need to see that. I need to, as a lawyer, I need to get that guilt, as a prosecutor, I need to get that guilty verdict thing, that immediate feedback effect. Cha-ching, I'm making a difference. I'm seeing the effect of my work in reality. Stop. He stopped me right there. That is a perfectly valid, that is you, Jim.
Yep.
And that's what we have to do. We have to look in the mirror and we have to say to ourselves, can we take that long-term, you know, an artist, for example, think of, I mean, a lot of objectivists may not like Van Gogh, but Van Gogh sold one painting in his whole life. And now he's regarded as maybe one of the top five painters of all time. And now, if you're willing to devote yourself like Van Gogh, in effect, for the love of the art itself,
yeah,
they end up a Van Gogh. And in future generations will, you know, whole museums will be devoted to you in Amsterdam. And in your own lifetime, though, what were you, a starving artist, but you did the thing you loved. Right. See, I can imagine that. I can imagine saying, I'll scrape by, but I'm doing the thing that I really love to do, painting.
Yep. And I think we all know that conflict.
So we have to make.
Speaking of the practical demands of life, Jeff Bannister is in with a super chat. Thank you very much for that. He sends the super sticker there, sending some love our way. And Richard Cameron is also in with a generous super chat and says, Robert seems to have a passion for underwater basket weaving. maybe it's because I've used that example before of impractical college degrees. There was something like that way back when, some class that included, it wasn't just underwater basket weaving, but that was part of the curriculum. Now, it sounds absurd, but we've all seen, course catalogs that had items that were no more absurd than that. The two examples, of course, I think of, one is the Fountainhead. Since you mentioned James, yeah, maybe you don't care that you have holes in your shoes. Howard Roark had a shirt where half the buttons were missing and he wore it to go see the dean of his school. So yes, we know for some people, their passion makes things like that irrelevant. But yeah, that film Whiplash and the Miles Teller character, and there are several examples in the film, but the one that stands out is he meets this charming girl and they go out on a date and they really, you know, he really likes her and she's really cute. And then as he's not able to make dates with her, and he actually tells her at some point, where I'm at right now, I really like you, but I don't have room for you in my life right now. And you think, oh, that sounds horrible. And for somebody like me, that, oh, that's terrible. I want more romance. It made perfect sense in the context of the movie. This is a man, a young man, a kid who is drumming at a level so good that to push to the next level, every spare hour of every day is spent. He's drumming to the level where he's got calluses on his hands, and then he's wearing through those and starting to bleed on his drums.
Hands are bleeding.
When you're achieving that level or pushing to achieve that level of greatness, you could even say romance has to wait. Everything else has to wait.
There are periods in our life that are like that sometimes. I mean, I remember being in law school. And law school, you know, the first 2 years when you go to an American law school, they're intentionally working your tail off. With the legend in those movies about those first and second year law students having to be monks, in effect, devoting themselves to the study of law, is kind of true. You know, there's the old saying, you know, they intentionally confuse you in the first year, and then which confuse you to death. Then they work you to death. Finally, by the third year, they bore you to death, making sure that you really know this stuff. But your first 2 years in American law school, you really do. Maybe it's my own limitations, I confess, but I really had to devote myself really almost exclusively. I mean, I tried to work out and exercise, but apart from basic self-care needs like bathing, working out, getting an occasional meal in, my life for those 2 years was devoted to law school. I wanted to do it properly. I wanted to really learn it. It wasn't easy. They weren't making it easy for me. And there are contexts in life where you say, okay, I'll still maybe, if I have a Saturday night, I'll still maybe go out with friends, or I'll still maybe go out on a date, find a girl and go out on a date. But I realize that I can't. There's no way I can be serious about a human relationship right now. And my friends and my love life are just going to have to suffer during this period of my life. Right. And that's just the way it is. I mean, there are contexts in life, too, that are like that. And really, to be great at anything, yes, requires that kind of devotion, at least a period of years where you're devoting yourself with that kind of intensity. If you really want to be the best, you know, Fred Astaire's and Gene Kelly's great film dancers, the best, they don't grow on trees. It's all hard, solid work, ladies right. and gentlemen, and total devotion to their craft. If you want to be the best, you have to put in the appropriate effort. It's called cause and effect.
Right. Yeah, when I grew up, we called that paying your dues, although I guess that's got kind of a bad taste in the mouth of some objectivists. Now, when I was growing up, no, you had to decide, do I want it bad enough that I'm going to do what it takes? Does our nonfiction writer want it bad enough that he's not going to take his girl out on fancy dates? He's going to be eating ramen and he's going to be doing whatever it takes to make that thing happen. Now, that might not have to go that far, but maybe it will.
12 years, I got pretty good. I could play some tough stuff, but knowing what it would take to be a pianist was a clear
level
in my mind. There's no way I'm going to devote the hours every day of practice that I need to be a concert pianist. That's not my value. I love music. I love piano music. I love even being able to play that and hear it for myself. But could it be my career? Not a chance, because I would have to devote myself hours every day to rigorous practice just to be as good as I would want to be if I'm devoted as a pianist. The higher the value, the harder it is to achieve.
Right. Now, speaking of values, in fact, speaking of the highest values, the next question we haven't got time for, but I want to tease people with this. I'm using the word tease intentionally, because Leonard Peikoff was asked, well, if sex, let me get back to sex and romance again, if sex is so crucial, would life be worth living if one's capacity to enjoy sex permanently disappeared? I think, James, we're going to have to leave that as an open question. My immediate reaction was, well, of course not. But as always, Leonard Peikoff surprises me. He always does. Even when I know exactly what his answer is, he manages to say it in a way that makes me, oh, wow, I hadn't thought about that aspect of it. But I want to tease that. And the reason is, in less than half an hour, the Daily Objective on the Ayn Rand Center UK, supported by your super chats, your memberships, your YouTube memberships. Thanks again to Jeff Bannister and Richard Cameron for that. In less than half an hour, you finally get to a topic I know you've been wanting to get to. It's time to talk about Star Wars in an episode entitled Yoda versus George Lucas, less than half an hour away on the Ayn Rand Center UK YouTube channel. And then after that, the reality show with the provocative title, How Much Should It Cost to Die? Well, that's going to be an interesting discussion that I don't want to miss either. So folks, thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. James, thank you for your insights. I've been making notes as we go. If folks are seeing me looking down or writing, it's because I think there's a lot in this episode. It's one that I'm going to re-listen to and again, be making notes. I think we'll be talking about free will. I want to talk about the style of a soul as it pertains to some of these questions. I hope folks have gotten as much out of this episode as I have. And we'll do it all again next week. It is made possible by those of you who are members of the Ayn Rand Center UK. And if you're not a member, let's say you're short on cash, we talked about, you might be a nonfiction writer. At a minimum, please give this show a like. Costs nothing to click that button. Give this show a share on your social networks. Not only does it cost nothing, it enhances your reputation sharing this kind of fine content and costs you $0.00. But if you can afford, what do we say, the price of a cup of coffee once a month, by all means, please sign up at aynrandcenter.co.uk. Click that membership button. Consider becoming a member of the YouTube as well. And James, thank you for a fantastic conversation. We will see everybody in 1 week.
Indeed. Be well.